The Legal Sunday, The Moral Aspect of the Question, Chapter 5. The objection to Sunday laws that to sustain them requires intellectual dishonesty and a non-judicial frame of mind in the judges. We have seen that the Brownist influence places our legislators in a non-legislative state of mind when it seeks to have them pass a Sunday law. No less baneful is its effect upon our judges when it seeks to have them sustain and apply such a law. In dealing with the question of their sustainment, and in dealing with the question of their construction and application, a judge dominated by the Brownist influence is in a non-judicial frame of mind. And first, of the question of sustainment. The judicial frame of mind requires that a judge, in ruling on the constitutionality of a statute, shall be governed by the Constitution alone, without the slightest reference to the wishes of the people as expressed otherwise than through that instrument. The people may change the instrument as their will may change. The judge must follow the will as therein laid down. But judges are human, and, like other men, are under the influence of the zeitgeist, or what appears to them to be such. And the Brownist religious sentiment has been so strenuously busying itself with this question ever since it obtained a foothold here that the zeitgeist in America has seemed to set against any fair discussion whatever of Sunday laws. Many persons desire the maintenance of these laws at any cost in the way of suppression or perversion of their fair consideration. And, while the balloting on such questions as Sunday streetcars, etc., has more than once indicated that in an American community of any considerable size, the Sunday law at any price men, whatever may be the case with the women, are a minority of the total population, they are a very large majority of the fussy, aggressive, meddlesome folk. They make a noise in the world out of all proportion to their real numbers and importance, and so they are too often mistaken for real representatives of the zeitgeist. It is also true that among the supporters of Sunday laws are included many of their systematic violators, who are quite sincerely persuaded that they are necessary for other people. But while it is true that the noise made by the Brownist Sunday law advocates is out of all proportion to their numbers and importance, it is an old story, the shallows murmur while the deeps are dumb. Nevertheless, as was said, this noise has its effect, and part of its effect on the minds of our judges is to produce the impression that an overwhelming majority of the people want the Sunday law sustained at any price. And our judges, being human, are thus biased in advance on this question, and caused to hunt up reasons whereby the Sunday law may be sustained, instead of examining its position under the Constitution without any bias toward one conclusion rather than another. They are acting by their light as servants of the people, trying to do their will. But they forget that for them, the will of the people is not to be gotten from Brownist pulpits nor Brownist newspapers, but from the Constitution alone. And they are, therefore, in a non-judicial frame of mind. Another effect of Brownism on judges as well as legislators is, by associating the Sunday law with the supposed special command of deity, to throw around it a peculiar halo of sanctity, which prevents its calm and critical examination, like other statutes, upon its merits as a statute exclusively. It is like that old subject of secession, which senators and representatives for so many years tacitly agreed should not be mentioned in the halls of Congress, though they talked all around it, and the people and papers outside openly debated it in every aspect. There is about the idea of our American Sunday something of that sacredness that certain statesmen used to ascribe to the Union. To impeach the eternal verity of the Sunday law or question its expediency is to touch the Lord's anointed. It is evident that no judicial consideration of a statute is to be expected of a judge who approaches the subject in such a frame of mind as this. The result of so approaching the consideration of a statute is fatally to blind the judge both with reference to the position and functions of the legislature and with reference to his own position and functions. He comes to look upon the legislature as, in some sort, the mouthpiece of deity, and, of course, this renders the expression of its will sacred, and inquiry into the authority of its deliverances rather in the nature of blasphemy or heresy. But this inquiry is one of the chief purposes of his official existence. For him, the legislature has properly no connection with deity. It is simply a part of a machine constructed by human agency for human purposes, and his business is to see to it that the part does not go beyond the purposes for which it was placed in the machine of government. And these purposes are defined and limited by the Constitution. When the question of the constitutionality of a statute is at issue, the judicial frame of mind requires that that question shall be settled by the Constitution alone. It no more admits of any deference to a command of deity, real or supposed, than it admits of deference to a change in the minds of the people, real or supposed, subsequent to the Constitution's adoption. So that, if there be a command of deity recorded anywhere outside of the Constitution, that a Sunday law with certain provisions shall be enacted, yet this will not render its enactment a legitimate exercise of legislative power, unless it be so under the Constitution. And, conversely, though there should be produced from some source an express command of deity that no Sunday laws shall be enacted, yet this will not render its enactment an illegitimate exercise of legislative power, unless it be so under the Constitution. So that the commands of deity have nothing whatever to do with the question of the constitutionality of a statute, except so far as those commands may be embodied in the Constitution. And when embodied therein, so far as the courts are concerned, they derive all their sanction and force from their embodiment, and no sanction or force whatever from the fact that they are commands of deity. Of course, there is a certain sense in which whatever is part of deity's plan for the outworking of mysterious purposes beyond our ken. But when we come, as we must come, for all practical purposes, to discriminate between good and evil, and to say of the first that it is the will or command of deity, and of the second that it is against such command, we see at once that the will of deity in this sense regards moral questions exclusively. And it is evident that a constitution must deal with many questions which have nothing whatever to do with morals. 1. It will be shown hereafter that neither constitutions nor statutes have anything whatever to do with moral questions as such. In other words, it must contain many provisions which are neither moral nor immoral, but are simply outside the domain of morals altogether. For example, a constitution provides for the number of members who shall constitute a legislature, the manner of their election, etc. Here is a matter on which no man will pretend that there is a record of deity's command. A constitution provides that there shall be no preference under the law of one religion over another. Here is a matter wherein many important persons consider that there is a flat defiance of deity's command that everybody, including the state as a body corporate, shall give a preference to the particular form of religion which they profess over all others. A constitution provides that Sunday shall be accepted in counting the number of days allowed the governor for considering bills. Many consider this as embodying the will of deity, that Sunday shall be kept as a holy day, and that no secular labor shall be performed. But though the first of these three things be not referred to in any recorded command of deity, and the second be against such command, and the third the expression of his will or command, yet when presented for judicial cognizance, all three of them stand on precisely the same level, are of the same binding character, and are to be regarded in precisely the same way. And as with constitutions, so with statutes, they too must deal with many matters untouched by any recorded commands of deity. It might be, too, that they would allow or direct that things shall be done which are in the very teeth of the recorded commands of deity. It might be that they would simply enjoin what is already commanded by deity. But in neither case has their relation to the commands of deity the slightest relevancy when the question is either as to their constitutionality or their construction. The prejudice produced by the influence of Brownism, that there is a special connection between a Sunday law and a divine command, blinds a judge as fatally to his own position and functions as it does to the position and functions of the legislature. He comes to look upon himself as in some sort the upholder, the expounder, and the enforcer of a divine command when this statute is before him, instead of regarding himself in his true light, as part of a machine constructed by human agency for human purposes alone, and like the governor of the steam engine, having for his special duty the seeing to it that the other parts operate in a regular and orderly manner according to the law of their being. He begins to feel that deity, instead of the Constitution, is the author of his official being, to imagine that he has, as judge, a mission from on high, instead of a mere commission from the governor or the people. And for him to falter in such a character, to look beyond this inspiration for guidance, seems like kicking against the pricks. And in his case, as in that of the legislator, all this implies a confusion of his personal and his official duty, and he ceases, in fact, to be a judge. Suppose he is fully persuaded in his own mind that there is a divine command that men should not work on Sunday. It by no means follows that such a belief will justify him in sustaining the constitutionality of a law compelling everybody to be idle on Sunday. The old Hebrew judges decided the guilt or innocence of a party arraigned before them on the charge of violating the fourth commandment without any reference to its validity, because, like all the rest of the law which they administered, it came from a source unquestioned and unquestionable. That it was a command of deity which it was their duty to enforce was a point not to be mooted. It is otherwise with an American judge. He has no commandments to enforce. He deals with statutes. The statutes with which he deals do not begin, "Thus saith the Lord." They begin with some such phrase as, "Be it enacted by the General Assembly," etc. And the very first question that he has to consider in dealing with a statute is, had the General Assembly authority to enact it? And if he permits himself to decide this question with reference to any command of deity, real or assumed, or with reference to anything whatsoever but the Constitution which created the Assembly and has defined and limited its sphere of action, then he is deciding a judicial question in a non-judicial frame of mind. His judicial oath included, his position justifies no such performance. His oath is to support the Constitution. If he does not support everything in that Constitution and refuse to support anything outside of it in his judicial capacity, utterly irrespective of his personal views of what is or is not a command of deity, then he breaks his judicial oath. If he finds that compliance with his oath forces him to violate a divine command, he may, of course, resign, but he cannot act judicially on the bench and break his oath. Even if there were an express command, "Thou shalt sustain the constitutionality of a Sunday law," no judge of ours could appeal to it as binding on his official action. To do so is at once to decide or judge purely religious questions, the question as to the verity of the command, the question to whom is it addressed, the question of the kind of Sunday law which might be referred to, etc., etc. And a judge who undertakes to decide such questions is setting up the union of church and state at once. And when he sustains a statute as the result of his conclusions on these points, he is giving effect to a law that grants a preference to one religion over another. And it may be added that to decide such questions is as impossible as it is illegitimate for our judges. They have no means whatever of ascertaining what is the will of deity, nor where it is recorded. They cannot decide for the Jew against the Mohammedan that it is recorded in the Pentateuch, or Hexateuch in modern parlance. They cannot decide for the Christian against the Jew that it is recorded in the New Testament as well as in the Old Testament of the King James Version. They cannot decide for the Roman Catholic against the Lutheran that it may be found in the Apocrypha as well as in the Testaments recognized by Protestants. Nor, assuming that a certain mandate, couched in human language, could be ruled by the courts to be an expression of the will of deity, would it be possible for them to authoritatively interpret that mandate when its meaning and application should be disputed. And it is hard to imagine a mandate couched in human language over which such a dispute might not arise. It will not do, then, for an American judge, any more than an American legislator, to imagine that in his official character he is an instrument in the hands of Providence. It will not do for him to be influenced in his official action by his private notions of what men ought or ought not to do. He may think it is the will of deity that men shall not work on Sunday, but this is not the slightest reason why he should sustain the constitutionality of a Sunday law. He may think it is the will of deity that no interest should be taken for the use of money. Yet he dare not refuse to give judgment for its recovery in any amount provided for by the law. It is surely the will of deity that the rich creditor should be merciful to his impoverished debtor. But the judge must sustain an execution for the uttermost farthing under the harshest conditions, unless the will of the state, as expressed in its law, allows some exemptions. In short, the will of deity, so far as the official action of the judge is concerned, is that he shall do his duty, and that duty consists in complying with his official oath to support the Constitution. We see, then, that the judge who permits his view of the Sunday law, or any other law in free America, to be clouded by his notions of what are and what are not commands of deity, confounds the official character of the legislator with his individual character, and his own duty as a judge with his duty as a man. And one who does this manifestly approaches the decision of the constitutionality of the Sunday law or its construction in a non-judicial frame of mind. And with a conscientious and intelligent judge, as with a conscientious and intelligent legislator, the very fact that he finds in a certain statute what he believes to be the embodiment of a divine command would arouse suspicion of the statute and excite to rigid self-examination. He would perceive that the recognition of a divine command, the determination of the question whether any particular command be divine or not, is a religious matter altogether, and that, in making up his own mind on the subject, he was necessarily giving a preference to one religion over another. And then he would naturally suspect that a statute which appeals to this preference in him embodies this preference in its provisions and commits the legislature thereto.
And this suggestion, based on his own sentiments or feelings, would be strengthened, as in the case of the legislator, by the intense interest of certain professional religionists in his sustainment of the statute, and the arguments, before him and elsewhere urged, as reasons for his sustaining it, would cooperate with his inner consciousness to convince him that such a preference was both intended and affected by the statute. And a judge, intellectual and conscientious, putting this and that together, to see the case cited in page 147 of the Spiritualist Camp Meeting, the religious character of which being disputed was left to the jury, would soon see that if he sustained the constitutionality of a law, either because of his own preference on religious grounds for the conduct it prescribed over any other conduct, or because of such a preference in other people, then he would be necessarily holding valid an act of the legislature which gave a preference to one religion over another, and holding it valid for that reason in the very teeth of the constitutional inhibition of any such preference. It was said, when speaking of the influence of Brownism on legislators, that it produced two prejudices, one with reference to a command of deity that men should be idle on Sunday, and one with reference to an intimate and necessary connection between the existence of a Brownist Sunday law and the common weal. This second prejudice also arises from the same influence on the bench. Its effect upon the legislator is evidently to throw him into a non-legislative frame of mind. For legislation requires that no proposed statute shall be passed, or the repeal of a statute be voted on, except after careful examination of details, within the document and without, an impartial consideration both of its provisions and of the conditions which it is required to meet.
The first question the true legislator must ask himself is, does expediency demand any legislation at all on this subject? And the second is, have I before me the most expedient legislation under the circumstances? As to many things, the first question may at once be answered affirmatively. It is admitted by all that we must have statutes or common law for murder, robbery, etc. But it is not admitted by all that we must have a Sunday law. And it is admitted by comparatively few that we must have a Brownist Sunday law. So that, When Brownism clouds the mind of a legislator with the prejudice that such a necessity exists for its Sunday law as exists for a law against murder or robbery, it prevents him from that examination of this question on its merits, which is absolutely necessary to the proper discharge of his duty as a legislator. A precisely similar effect results from this prejudice about the connection of a Brownist Sunday law with the common weal on the bench. It inclines our judges to associate the general welfare so intimately with a Brownist Sunday law that they are impressed with the idea that they must sustain the law at any price, and prevents them from giving it that impartial consideration on its merits which their official oath requires them to give. There is no logical connection between the proposition that a law is a good thing to have and the proposition that a legislature under a written constitution may pass the law. But it is true that a judge is biased in advance when he imagines that a statute before him is in some special way promotive of the general welfare. And the influence of Brownism goes farther than this. It does not only foster the impression that the Brownist Sunday law is a good thing to have, it tends to foster the impression that the law is a thing which it is absolutely necessary for us to have. And to consider its constitutionality under the influence of such an impression as this is to approach the subject in a non-judicial frame of mind. But here let us refer again to what has already been said in extenuation of intellectual dishonesty. Our judges are entitled, like the persecutors of old and those would-be persecutors, the Brownist clergy of today, to the benefit of that religio-psychologic principle which forbids one soul to adjudge the responsibility of another for its belief or its way of arriving thereat, which teaches that sincerity may well exist where it seems to be totally lacking, which warns us that the most able and the most honest of men may be satisfied in their own minds that a train of reasoning has driven them to a certain conclusion, when, in reality, the conclusion was predetermined and the reasoning invented or distorted to fit it. With this truly Christian and right allowance for human infirmity, we shall forfend the imputation of disrespect for the bench, while we examine and weigh without fear or favor, and on the merits of the case alone, the various grounds upon which the established Church of Brownism, as embodied in the idle and cheerless Sunday, has been sustained in American law. And this mercilessness in dealing with the positions taken, while neither feeling nor expressing disrespect for those who have taken them, is absolutely necessary to any profitable discussion of the subject. Because, when a judge approaches a question of law in a non-judicial frame of mind, and when he therefore bases his conclusions upon reasons which did not lead him thereto, and could not lead any judicial reasoner thereto, he is guilty, consciously or unconsciously, of intellectual dishonesty. And the evil results of intellectual dishonesty to mankind are the same, whether he who practices it does so with malice aforethought and evil intent, or otherwise. The clergyman who practices it, though his own conscience may acquit him of willfully doing so, is, when detected, under a suspicion fatal to his usefulness. And it is obvious that the state of a judge's conscience has nothing whatever to do with the effect on the material interests of the community of his considering questions brought before him in a non-judicial frame of mind. Is it a fact that American judges have approached the consideration of Sunday laws under the prejudice that Sunday idleness is divinely commanded, and that they have wrongfully permitted that prejudice to influence their view of these laws? Let us see. In New York, we are told by Judge Kent, the statute has for over a century recognized the sanctity of the day and punished its, the sanctity's, violators. 1 Ruggles case, 8 Johns, 290. In Georgia, the code denominates Sunday the Lord's Day, and as the Lord's Day, all courts and magistrates are to consider it. 2 Salter v. Smith, 244. And the Sunday law of that state but reenacts the law of the Almighty. 3 Johnston's case, 102. In Arkansas, the day is set apart by divine appointment as well as by the law of the land. 4 Stockland's case, 186. In Pennsylvania, the phrase is divine command and human legislation, 5 Davis versus Fish. And in Iowa, we are told that the idle and cheerless Sunday is established by laws both human and divine, 6 Bass versus Irwin, 436. Now, the language of these cases is not rare nor exceptional. They are types of a very large number, and the spirit which pervades them and which prompts the use of such language pervades many others. When we remember that this language is used in cases where the sole question involved was the constitutionality of a human statute passed by a human legislature whose being was created and whose powers were limited by a human constitution, we appreciate the fact that it unerringly indicates a non-judicial frame of mind.